This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Amendment to eliminate corporate personhood. More information about Scott and the event can be found at kboo.fm/ScottSilber2013.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new report reveals illegal and unsafe practices in Oregon's forest working industry.
A federal court rejects the Oregon Humane Society's request to halt the killing of sea lions at Bonneville Dam.
And Pennsylvania residents challenge a gag order that prevents discussion of fracking at public meetings.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 15th, 2013. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Zeke Harrington. Despite experiencing a major budget shortfall, potentially jeopardizing both TriMet workers' health benefits and leading to bus service cuts, TriMet General Manager Neil McFarlane is planning to hire several new executives. While the plans are not finalized, according to TriMet, McFarlane has been in conversation with several high-level candidates about a new deputy executive manager position. McFarlane has also considered hiring an expensive consultant for the transit agency. In a recent speech on Wednesday, McFarlane claimed that if transit workers did not agree to major cuts to their union health care benefits, there would be severe cuts to bus services as a result. He predicts that by 2025, 70% of all transit will be cut in the Portland metro area. Already, there has been a 14% service cut since 2009. The Amalgamated Transit Union 757 has appealed the arbitrator's decision to cut their health care benefits, but the results of this appeal have not yet been announced. Transit Union President Bruce Hansen claims that instead of taking responsibility for huge management expenditures, McFarlane is putting the blame on the union.
Earlier today, U.S. District Court Judge Michael Simon denied a request from the Humane Society of the United States to halt the killing of sea lions at the Bonneville Dam. This was Humane Society's third time in court to protect the sea lions during the last year. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with the Humane Society's Marine Issues Field Director, Sharon Young.
Ostensibly, to protect endangered salmon, the state of Oregon has a federal permit to kill nearly 100 sea lions per year. Animal rights activists call into question this strategy. Here is Sharon Young of the Humane Society.
The National Marine Fisheries Service approved a permit to kill California sea lions up to 92 a year at the Bonneville Dam. The reason for the permit was that the states of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho alleged that they were having a significant negative impact on a salmon run, and the permit was approved. The Humane Society of the United States filed a lawsuit to try to overturn the permit on the grounds that there are far greater impacts that are allowed, including up to 17% of the run that can be taken by fishermen, literally millions of fish being eaten by non-native bass and walleye that are in the river for sport fishermen, and that the predation rate of the sea lions, which is only about 1%, is nowhere nearly as significant as these other impacts that they've allowed.
Well, how do you think sea lions got to be the poster child of eating salmon?
Well, you know, I think as a species, we're pretty good at trying to shift the blame to things beside ourselves. And I think whenever it's a situation of competition or perceived competition between us and another species, oftentimes the other species is, in this case, put on a hit list.
What do you consider is a better way forward, and how can we achieve that?
You know, I think to some extent there are recommendations that have been made about how to cut down the number of haulouts in the area that the sea lions can use, and certainly trying to eliminate some of the real problems facing the salmon would mean that whatever predation occurs is really not going to be an issue for them.
And what about just our average listeners? Is there anything they can do if they're concerned about sea lions being killed this way?
Well, I mean, I think if your average listener is concerned, as we are, that these animals are being unfairly scapegoated for impacts that humans are having. They certainly can contact the officials in the states of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho and tell them that they oppose this program and they don't want them to do it. You know, the salmon runs, according to the National Marine Fisheries Service, are all either stable or increasing, so it's not an urgent crisis that all of a sudden has to be dealt with. And we would hope that people would argue for a more rational solution. I should tell you, though, that we just had a decision from the court today that ruled against us in the litigation. So at this point, we're reading the opinion and are planning to appeal it.
Any hopes for victories in the court?
We certainly hope so. The program makes absolutely no sense at all to do when you realize the real problems facing the salmon and what a small part of it predation is.
Any other clues as to why the state is taking this route?
I think they feel it's a lot easier to kill sea lions than it is to deal with the real problems that are facing them. They would have to remove all of the bass and walleye from the river rather than continuing to encourage those non-native fish populations that are eating millions of salmon, instead of trying to get them out of the river completely the way they do northern pike minnow, because they're a big money sport fishing industry. They are allowing them to stay in the river and have their populations be maintained for the pleasure of sport fishermen, even as government reports have said that they're eating millions of young salmon a year and are a dramatic impact on the recovery. And furthermore, the Blue Ribbon science panels have found that the way that the hatcheries are being managed is actually interfering with recovery as well. So, you know, we are asking that the government do things that really matter rather than focusing on something like this. It seems like a simple fix, but it's not an answer to the problem of salmon recovery at all.
Well, Sharon Young, who speaks for the Sea Lions, thanks so much for talking to KBOO.
Thank you.
And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Washington State education officials submitted a progress report this week to the federal government in an attempt to sidestep the unpopular No Child Left Behind law. Last July, the U.S. Department of Education granted Washington a conditional waiver that still required faculty evaluations and other school accountability systems. Under the No Child Left Behind Act, a school missing just one of 37 objectives is considered failing and punished with a reduction in funding. Washington's proposed school accountability system puts a greater emphasis on struggling schools showing signs of improvement. Schools not meeting every goal will not be punished for failing as long as progress is still being made. The state also challenged current testing requirements. The waiver application focused on a more holistic approach to standardized tests, with the addition of science testing. This progress report was filed in the midst of a growing student movement led by Seattle students to challenge the standardized testing requirements in that state. Washington State expects to have a finalized waiver by the start of the next school year.
The Portland City Club held a forum today on the future of public education funding in Oregon. Proponents of a program called Pay It Forward described their idea, which is a social insurance program that students would join instead of getting a loan. Students would have no debt, no interest, and their percentage would never change. Instead, graduates would pay their contribution as a payroll deduction, similarly to how we pay Social Security taxes. This means that their contribution would be a dependable, affordable expense. For example, a recent grad making $30,000 a year would pay $900 a year for their past education. Later on, when they make $60,000 a year, they would pay $1,800 to pay it forward. According to its proponents, over time, the Pay It Forward plan will create a stable funding stream for Oregon public higher education. Nathan Hunt spoke with KBOO's Chris Andre at the City Club today after the forum.
People that are apprehensive about the job market would be more likely to go to school under Pay It Forward, because when you don't have to take on that debt. I mean, we had a person with a question earlier today. She went to a great law school. She's making payments, $800 a month, and this is long after she graduated. A lot of people, when they look at their options, they say, I'd like to go back to school to become more employable. They look at the debt they have to incur. They say, you know what, even if I get a better job, I may be no better off. So I think more people would go to school. And I think, you know, yeah, they'd be going there for these self-serving reasons that I want to get job training. But they would be getting exposure to all of those liberal arts curricula that our universities provide to people. I think the biggest stabilizer, just by the models that we've looked at, which I mentioned in the speech, was that, you know, in year 28, when you have a full 24 cohorts paying into the fund, it's expected to see surpluses of $158 million a year. So you have a buffer there to where if there's a shock of incoming students, there's money there to take care of that. But it's really in the long run that it has that stability. Over the first 24 years, it's going to be an expensive investment the state's going to have to make.
That was Nathan Hunt with Pay It Forward. The group says its plan will provide a solution to the skyrocketing cost of higher education in Oregon. Oregon students now graduate from our public universities with an average of $25,000 in student loan debt.
Oregon lawmakers made small changes today in a pending bill that would give undocumented immigrant students access to in-state tuition at public universities. House Bill 2787, sometimes known as the Oregon Dream Act, would allow the State Board of Higher Education to approve in-state tuition for some students who lack immigration documents. Today's changes to the bill include clarifying what proof students must have, showing that they intend to become citizens. Republicans and Democrats both agreed to exempt students who have served in the military from the bill's residency requirements. Due to these changes, lawmakers will have to wait for an updated fiscal analysis on the bill before it is allowed to move out of committee next week.
This week, Oregon's Willamette National Cemetery became the first of its kind to provide burial services for the same-sex partner of a veteran. This landmark event does not follow any change in marriage legislation for people serving in the military and their families. The 1996 Defense of Marriage Act officially defines marriage as an institution between a man and a woman. The federal government, therefore, does not provide benefits to military couples like Linda Campbell and Nancy Litchfield, who are registered with the state of Oregon and legally married in Canada. Campbell's career with the U.S. Air Force began in 1968. When her wife died of breast cancer in December, she requested a burial rights waiver from the Department of Veterans Affairs. The department granted the waiver over a month later after the Bureau of Labor and Industries threatened a civil rights complaint against both the cemetery and the department's secretary, Eric Shinseki.
A group of five teenagers in Gresham assaulted a 24-year-old gay man from Clackamas last night, reportedly for his sexual orientation. The four teenagers lured the man to a park with promises of sexual favors, and when he arrived, physically assaulted him. The men then stole his wallet, cell phone, and other belongings. Police suspect that this group has been harassing other gay men in the park with similar strategies. Three suspects are so far in custody, although little is known about the other two.
Two Oregon state legislatures want the public to have more oversight over how the Oregon health plan runs. Community care organizations, or CCOs, are private contractors hired by the state to manage health care access. The federal government gave Oregon nearly $2 billion to set them up. But these groups are allowed to keep the public out of their meetings, and the public has no say over their budgets. On Wednesday, Oregon Senator Chip Shields introduced a bill requiring CCOs to hold their board meetings in public. State Representative Mitch Greenlick has introduced a bill to have community councils approve all CCO budgets. Those who testified against more public oversight told local news website The Lund Report that CCOs need to handle some financial information in private. They also said community groups should only review budgets, not approve them. Representative Greenlick said the public should be able to examine CCOs because of Oregon's strong tradition of open government.
Newly released documents show that Washington Mutual Bank, known locally as WaMu, engaged in cost-cutting practices that led them to make too many risky loans. The papers were released as part of an ongoing lawsuit filed by financial services firm Dexia. Dexia claims that because of cuts to quality control personnel, the bank was able to engage in more high-risk lending. Washington Mutual practices included approving mortgages to underqualified applicants and directing outside consultants to give passing grades to subprime loans that they had previously deemed defective. The bank then bundled these high-risk mortgages into securities and sold them to investors. These problems extended to J.P. Morgan, which bought WaMu in 2008, as well as Bear Stearns, which was also purchased by J.P. Morgan. The head of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, told prosecutors in the case that he should not be blamed for what Bear Stearns and WaMu did before he purchased them. But the lawsuit claims the J.P. Morgan executives engaged in many of the same practices that WaMu and Bear Stearns did to increase the bank's number of subprime loans in order to increase profits.
A new report has found that illegal labor practices are common at forest work sites in southern Oregon. The report was published this week by the Alliance of Forest Workers and Harvesters and UC Berkeley's Labor Occupation Health Program. They began the study 2 years ago after a 22-year-old Oregon forest worker died when his chainsaw kicked back and struck him in the neck. The study focused on Spanish-speaking immigrant workers in southern Oregon. Researchers found that forest maintenance work is already dangerous due to weather, terrain, wild animals, and the equipment workers use. But it is made more dangerous by employer practices. Inexperienced workers are often placed at the front of the line. Workers are also made to work too closely to each other and are not given the 10-minute breaks every 4 hours they're required under the law. Some report they are also pressured to work even when sick or injured. In addition, close to half of the workers said they are not paid overtime when they put in more than 40 hours in a week. The study's authors say that state agencies should work harder to make companies comply with labor laws.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. We'll look back at 1 Billion Rising, yesterday's international call to end violence against women. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is cloudy with a slight chance of showers through the weekend.
It is 5:18 p.m. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Guess what? George Bush is back. Not Poppy Bush, as George H.W. was known, nor the George known simply as W. Rather, farther down the family tree, a brand new Bush is trying to use his powerful family name and connections to sprout a career in the rich soil of right-wing Texas politics. Meet George P. Bush, already dubbed Puppy. Son of former Florida Governor Jeb, this 36-year-old has been a corporate lawyer, a private equity hustler, and is presently in energy investments. But lately, George P. has been working the family Rolodex for his fledgling effort to grab the statewide office of land commissioner. He has already sacked up about $1.4 million, a wad of startup cash that would have been impossible to get if his name was George P. Bust. Practically all of this bankroll came from family, including $50,000 from Uncle W., or from special interest donors long tied to the Bush political network, including donations of $10,000 to $65,000 each from 7 Texas oil operators and assorted far-right-wing billionaires. Among his billionaire backers are Bob Perry, a Houston-based housing developer, and Harold Simmons, a Dallas-based waste disposal baron. Both dumped tens of millions of dollars into the GOP's ferociously negative attack ads against Barack Obama last year. Also, both are infamous pay-to-play corporatists who like to buy into up-and-coming politicians who can be trusted to deliver governmental favors to them over the long haul. So it's not for nothing that they are the two biggest donors nourishing young Bush's run for this little-known Texas office. This is Jim Hightower saying, George P. has the pure Bush pedigree and is already on the corporate leash. One watchdog group tracing the money interest feeding and training this pup is Texans for Public Justice. Find them at tpj.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The San Bernardino County coroner confirmed yesterday that remains found in a burned-down cabin are those of ex-LAPD officer Christopher Dorner. Though this concludes a major chapter in the incident, controversy lingers about how he was killed, specifically whether San Bernardino sheriff's deputies had intended to take Dorner alive. KPFK's Larry Buell has more on the story.
A fiery siege in Big Bear Tuesday ended the hunt for and the life of Christopher Dorner, but questions are being raised about the final showdown. At first, authorities said they didn't know how the fire started. Then they suggested Dorner started the fire himself. On Wednesday, the San Bernardino County Sheriff admitted they used incendiary tear gas, also called hot gas canisters, as a last resort, but that they didn't intend to burn the cabin. That statement is at odds with officers' comments picked up on police scanners and local TV news, including the quote, "Burn this."
We're going to go forward with the plan with the burner.
Burners is police slang for tear gas canisters, which are known to cause fires. Police abuse investigator Diop Kamau is CEO of National Police Complaint Center and a former police sergeant. He says officers didn't plan to bring Dorner out alive.
Doesn't appear that every possible means of taking him down without killing him was explored.
Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
The Kentucky Senate passed a bill allowing farmers to grow hemp yesterday, moving the issue forward on the national stage. Although the bill passed with 31-6 votes, it faces tougher chances in the Kentucky House of Representatives. Kentucky's Governor Steve Beshear is also skeptical, citing law enforcement concerns. If passed, Kentucky would be the first state to allow industrial hemp cultivation, although 8 others recognize hemp as a non-drug and have already removed barriers to its production. Also on Thursday, Kentucky's Republican Senators Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell, along with Oregon Democratic Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley, sponsored a federal bill removing hemp from the list of controlled substances. Their U.S. Senate bill is similar to the one in the U.S. House that Northern Kentucky Representative Thomas Massey sponsored earlier this week.
New York City announced today it has divested its teachers' pension fund from gun and ammunition manufacturers. The move pulls more than $13 million out of 5 publicly traded companies. After the Sandy Hook school shooting in December, the Teachers Retirement System Board began a review. Their decision makes the pension fund the largest yet to divest from gun manufacturers. New York City's comptroller, John Liu, said in a statement there was no need to support the gun manufacturers, quote, whose products can destroy lives and shatter communities in the blink of an eye. The teachers' union called the decision, quote, the right thing to do. Several other jurisdictions across the country are considering similar moves. The Chicago Municipal Pension Fund voted to divest from gun companies at the end of January. Today, President Obama posthumously honored the 6 adult victims of the Sandy Hook shooting with the Presidential Citizens Medal, the second highest civilian honor awarded by the U.S.
The controversial practice of gas and oil extraction known as fracking has prompted debate across the country. But in one upstate New York town, officials have banned the debate of fracking at public meetings. Officials in Sanford, near the Pennsylvania border, claim that fracking discussions were contentious and were taking up too much time at meetings. But critics have called the order an infringement on free speech, stifling public debate. This week, the National Resources Defense Council and the Catskill Citizens for Safe Energy filed a suit against the town seeking to have the ban lifted. One Sanford resident, Melissa Bishop, told the NRDC that the board's restriction went beyond the issue of fracking.
Someone could just come and say, okay, no more discussion at all, really galled a lot of people. And they knew, even if they didn't know if there was a right or wrong to the fracking discussion, they certainly knew that there was a right or wrong to the issue of free speech, and this was definitely wrong.
Sanford sits atop the Marcellus Shale, an area rich with gas deposits. In other fracking news this week, U.S. Senator Ron Wyden called for more transparency by companies involved in the practice of hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Marty Hayden from the public interest law firm Earth Justice spoke with KABU about Wyden's demand.
This week, Senator Wyden had his first oversight hearing as chair of the Senate Energy Committee, and it was on natural gas. And one of the things he was really pushing on was disclosure of these fracking chemicals, of the witnesses, of the natural gas company witnesses and the administration witnesses he had. And the Bureau of Land Management has been working on a fracking rule, a piece of which has been disclosure, and a draft of that rule leaked on Friday, and the Bureau of Land Management is still going to let, as it stands right now, they're going in the direction of letting companies still hide behind trade secrets and hence keep secret the poisons that they're pumping into your water. Another piece of the fracking rule that is about testing well integrity, the cement collar that they have in the well, how safe that is. And the rule that the BLM had proposed called for testing the wells before you frack, and the one that was leaked Friday moved that till after you fracked. So after the poisons have already been pumped down, then they will test whether or not the wells can withstand it.
That was Marty Hayden of Earth Justice speaking with KABU about Oregon Senator Ron Wyden's call for increased transparency by companies involved in hydraulic fracturing.
Lawmakers and activists are using the death of Internet activist Aaron Swartz to speak out against the Justice Department's heavy-handed application of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. A number of bills have already been proposed to reduce the criminal penalties for some computer crimes. For more, KABU's Joe Meyer spoke with author and former federal prosecutor Peter Torin.
Computer programmer and Internet freedom activist Aaron Swartz was a developer of the popular web feed format RSS, the website framework WebPy, and the social news site Reddit. In January of 2011, Swartz was arrested by the FBI on breaking and entering charges in connection with his downloading of academic journal articles. Federal prosecutors charged him with 2 counts of wire fraud and 11 violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, carrying a maximum penalty of up to 35 years in prison and a $1 million fine. Earlier this year, at age only 26, Aaron Swartz was found dead in his New York apartment where he had hanged himself. I spoke with Peter Torin, author and former prosecutor with the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section of the U.S. Department of Justice, about the case.
He was indicted for downloading academic materials from a database called JSTOR, which is a database that has a lot of academic journals, but to obtain legitimate access, you have to pay a fee. And he downloaded thousands, if not tens of thousands, of documents with the intent, apparently, from what I've read, to distribute them on the internet without charge. And as he said, to set them free.
Right. So fundamentally, he believed information ought to be free, like a lot of computer programmers. And how does that run afoul of the law then?
He was, I think, a fellow at Harvard, and he could have accessed JSTOR legally through Harvard. He accessed it through an MIT account and took steps to basically hide what he was doing. So he was charged with a number of federal laws, including wiretapping, but most particularly a number of violations of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which basically makes illegal and unauthorized an access to a computer without authorization or in excess of authorization. And here, they basically said that he violated the terms of use of the agreement of this particular, the JSTOR database, by downloading the millions of pages of documents without authorization.
And what was he facing then?
It's not entirely clear. One of the misconceptions is that in the press, there are a lot of reports that he was facing 20 years or 25 years, and that was basically worked up because each statute or violation could carry up to 5 years, but that's not how he would have been sentenced if in fact he had been found guilty. He would have been sentenced pursuant to the sentencing guidelines, which are used to sentence based on the value of the information obtained and things like that. So I think realistically he could have been facing a short prison term if he'd been found guilty on all his counts.
And moving forward, is there a move to amend or change the U.S. laws?
Yes, there's been a number of now bills that have been introduced in Congress, most prominently by Zoe Lofgren of California, that would amend the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that would not make it or would take away the criminal provisions of somebody accessed a computer merely in violation of a computer use policy. The computer use policy standing alone is not enough to create a criminal violation.
Do you see this in a larger framing of access to information in a democratic society? Is there a larger story here?
I think there are a number of larger stories. I think that there's the question of, you know, the protecting information protecting information is a story. What kind of information can and should be protected? And I think there's also a larger story of perhaps how the prosecutors act in this case, and really with the underlying story of prosecutorial discretion in the federal criminal justice system.
That was former federal prosecutor Peter Torin. In the wake of the suicide death of an internet activist, Congress is considering reining in penalties for some computer crime. And I'm Joe Meyer with KABU News.
Yesterday's second anniversary of pro-democracy protest in Bahrain was marked by the shooting of a 16-year-old boy. Al Jazeera reports that the victim, Hussein al-Jaziri, was shot and killed with a shotgun at close range during a protest in a village west of Bahrain's capital, Manama. Excessive force against mostly peaceful protesters has left 80 dead since unrest began in the country. The first round of a national dialogue began on Sunday. These talks, the first in 18 months, include representatives from opposition groups as well as pro-government groups. However, little is known about the nature of the national dialogue. Opposition groups continued to push for political reforms against of the constitutional monarchy and an elected prime minister. For more on the story, Air Cascadia spoke with Bahraini journalist Reem Khalifa.
Well, you know, the situation has not really changed. It's just that it's getting worse. Today, also, there was a heavy confrontation still going on in various areas. On the main Bidea highway, the police used tear gas and stun grenade, and while the protesters used stones. And I would like to highlight two things. Yesterday was the second anniversary for the Bahraini uprising, and today all opposition societies called for a mass rally. And in the rally, actually, the youth decided to go in the other side to confront the security forces as they disagree with the dialogue that the opposition decided in the last minute last week to participate with the other of the government parties. Basically, you can see what's happening. After 2 years, there is a division between the young people calling for the down of the regime, while the opposition is calling for a reform within the constitutional monarchy. Not to forget also that